Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Iron Rod Podcast, number 139. This is Taylor here with Chris. And when I say here, I really mean here.
This is the first time we've ever been literally face to face while recording in the same room.
Yes, a meter apart.
That's right.
And where are we, Chris?
So we are in Salt Lake City. And it's 24 hours before we present at Sunstone. So we were just wrapping up our final preparations for that presentation. But we know that hell hath no fury like an Iron Rod podcast listener with no podcast on Sunday morning. So we're making sure we at least get an episode out for you guys complaining.
Oh, come on. Our listeners aren't. They're complainers. They're questioners, and they should be, right? They're just searching and they're questioning.
I love the fact that they are so hungry for the podcast that it bothers them when it doesn't show up on time. So it's good.
Yeah, exactly. I flew in yesterday. You flew in today. I just have to relate one thing that happened this last week. There was a listener, not to the podcast, but someone who had heard the interview that I had given on Radio Free Mormon, who had bought the book, read it, in 2 or 3 days and contacted me and just wanted to talk about it. I was actually back east at Oshkosh, which some of you airplane enthusiasts will know what I'm talking about. And we just had a great conversation. And it's amazing to see people who are starting to wake up to the true history and where we are today. And it's just really gratifying that we can be part of the Lord's work in some small way. I think this is our way to contribute to what he's doing in preparation for the marvelous work. So I'm privileged to do this with you. In fact, today we're going to be going over Doctrine and Covenants, Section 77, which is a question and answer that takes place when Joseph is translating from the Book of Revelation. And this is in March of 1832 in Hiram, Ohio. And he states this in the history, in connection with the translation of the scriptures, I received the following explanation of the revelation of St. John. Just a couple of things to note. Joseph has questions. Sydney might be part of this because Sydney is helping him out here. We don't have a specificity as to whether or not it's Joseph or Sydney asking the question, but they probably both were like, what does this mean? And they go to the Lord, they ask a question, the Lord answers them, and they write it down.
And publish it.
Exactly.
Well, I guess technically they didn't publish it. This was actually one of the sections that was not added until 1876. But it was written down in March of 1832, so they do know it happened. We also know that Joseph and Sidney stopped working on the translation to head down to Missouri. And the records indicate that when they left, they had completed Revelation chapter 11. This section covers up through Revelation chapter 11 as well. So it totally fits with the time frame and the other records we have. So yeah, these were the questions that they were having while they were translating those first 11 chapters, and Joseph wrote down the answers.
Yes, and we are the beneficiaries of those answers. And I don't think in today's episode we want to get too deep into actually what's going on in the Book of Revelation, except to just give some context, because some of these questions are very specific. But let's just go through it. It's pretty short. I don't think we're going to get past Section 77 onto 78 today. Just in the interest of time. But question one, and this is from John chapter 4, verse 6. What is the sea of glass spoken of by John in the 4th chapter, 6th verse? And the answer is, it is the earth in its sanctified, immortal, and eternal state.
The sea of glass, if we go read that verse from the Book of Revelation, it says, before the throne, there was a sea of glass like unto crystal, and in the midst of the throne and round about the throne were four beasts full of eyes before and behind. We're going to focus in on the sea of glass first. It's in front of the throne, before the throne, and it's like unto crystal. This links us to Exodus 24, where Moses and Aaron and the 70 elders go up to Mount Sinai to meet with the Lord in person. And it says in Exodus 24, 9 and 10, that they saw the God of Israel, and there was under his feet, as it were, a paved work of sapphire stone, and as it were, the body of heaven in his clearness. And that's kind of a weird phrasing. If you go look at the Berean Study Bible, a modern translation, it says, under his feet was a work like a pavement made of sapphire, as clear as the sky itself. Really sounds like a sea of glass. It's flat,
crystal
pavement. Right, a sea like a crystal,
exactly.
When you read Revelation chapters 4 and 5, the context is a divine council meeting. The council is there to talk about unleashing God's judgment on the earth, where the wicked are going to be punished and the righteous are going to be vindicated and the martyrs are going to be avenged. And these supernatural powers are going to eventually be destroyed, and the nations of the world, the people, are going to be healed. But in the course of doing that, there's going to be all bad. But eventually, in the Lord's time, kind of Eden will be restored again. You can go read Revelation chapter 4, and it tracks really closely with Daniel chapter 7, which is also another divine council meeting thing. All of this, we have the sea before the throne of God. And in the Bible, waters are normally a force of chaos that's in opposition to the Lord. And that's where the beast in Revelation comes up from. And the woman Babylon rides upon the waters, sits upon the waters. And yet in this case, the waters are completely still. The chaos is gone. It's like a sea of glass or crystal because God has tamed it and God's in control now. When I see all of those, and Joseph says it's the earth in its sanctified, immortal, and eternal state, I don't think he's necessarily talking about the globe, but the people. All of his creation is in a sanctified, immortal, and eternal state.
Interesting, because I had always thought that when the Lord talks about standing upon the sapphire, that would seem to be a physical something, right? A crystal. It's not just the people. It's a sanctified state of the earth that also includes the people in this. And with what you just said, it's pretty tranquil, right? It's the peace that exists. It's the glory that exists. And he's, again, these are figurative expressions.
Yeah, I think that's the key thing, is this is very symbolic. And so if you think about the Lord reigns supreme and the earth is his footstool, we can think very literally and say, okay, this hunk of space rock is what the Lord is going to physically stand upon. Okay, that's one, but a figurative, symbolic would be the people, the chaos is going to be driven out and it's going to be total control, and that's what the Lord reigns over. Obviously, the book of Revelation is very symbolic. So
you got to be careful not to be too literal.
Yes.
But you don't necessarily cast some of those literal interpretations out, but recognize that some of it could be very figurative. And I think we get to this next in the second question in the same verse. What are we to understand by the four beasts spoken of in the same verse? And you just read that. And the answer is they are figurative expressions used by the revelator, John, in describing heaven, the paradise of God, the happiness of man, and of beasts, and of creeping things, and of the fowls of the air, that which is spiritual being in the likeness of that which is temporal, and that which is temporal in the likeness of that which is spiritual, the spirit of man in the likeness of his person, and also the spirit of the beast, and every other creature which God has created. Again, we get back to, are we describing the spiritual world or the temporal world? And they all have their likeness. It's a happy place he's describing here, the paradise of God, the felicity and the happiness of man and of beasts and of everything else. And people have questioned, well, are there going to be beasts in heaven? And I think this answers the question, that God saves all of his creations. And it's not only us humans.
One thing to point out here is in the book of Revelation, when it talks about the beasts, you see these four beasts, we shouldn't think of like wild animals. The Greek word is really just meaning living beings, creations. Evil powers are also described under the emblem of these beasts throughout the scriptures. But these beasts here, these living beings, don't really represent the evil of the world, but they're really representing kind of the different types of creation. One way to look at it would be you've got man, you've got birds, you've got domesticated animals, the ox, and you've got wild animals, the lion. So in one way, this could be a way of expressing the totality of God's creation. And that goes into the next verse 3, where it says, are the four beasts limited to individual beasts, or do they represent classes or orders? And Joseph's answer is they are limited to four individual beasts, which were shown to John, to represent the glory of the classes of beings in their destined order or sphere of creation, in the enjoyment of their eternal felicity. They're individuals that represent a group. And so I think our key message here is to look at the group and say, yeah, the totality of God's creation, domesticated animals and wild animals, man and birds, all of that is going to be saved.
Yeah, I just pulled the Bible up while we're doing this, and the English Standard Version talks about four living creatures. So does the New International Version, the Berean Study Bible. So I think beasts has this grotesque, you know, like monsterish sort of connotation in English. And maybe we should just start using four living creatures here for the purposes of this description.
And now, to really kind of shake things up a little bit, we go back to Revelation. It says the first beast was like a lion, the second was like a calf, the third had a face of a man, and the fourth was a flying eagle. They each had six wings, and they were full of eyes, and they were saying, holy, 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 the Lord God Almighty. For a Jew reading this, they're immediately going to go to Isaiah chapter 6. You say, wait a minute. When Isaiah went and saw God sitting on his throne, that's what the seraphim were saying. Holy, holy, holy is the Lord. So even these beasts, these creatures, are praising and worshiping God in this heavenly vision here. And then that links us to Ezekiel chapter 1. Ezekiel sees a similar vision, and he saw creatures that had a human face, the face of a lion, the face of an ox, and the face of an eagle. So we get the same animals there. They were full of eyes. And then in Isaiah chapter 6, those seraphim had six wings as well. So we've got all of this imagery that's consistent between Isaiah and Ezekiel and John the Revelator that are all trying to tell the same story using similar imagery.
And the thing that strikes me is, again, they are all worshiping the Lord. And we actually get a little bit more of that as we go down a little bit further. Question 4. What are we to understand by the eyes and the wings which the beasts had? Their eyes are a representation of light and knowledge. That is, they are full of knowledge. And their wings are a representation of power to move, to act, etc. So, do they actually have wings? Do they have multiple eyes? Well, they were seen as having these in the vision, but their representation of wisdom, I'm putting wisdom for knowledge, in knowledge and light, but if somebody is enlightened and has knowledge, then they're wise. And then that power to move represented by the wings, the ability to go about, to do presumably what the Lord commands them to do in the eternal realms.
Yep. Yeah, I've heard some people describe it as, you know, two wings to help with your movement, two wings to kind of hide your presence, because you can't see angels unless they want you to see them. Again, these are symbolic representations because they don't literally have wings. And nowhere in the Bible does it talk about angels having wings. Same thing with the eyes. It is a symbolic description because in Ezekiel, he not only sees creatures with eyes, but there's the wheels on the chariot throne that God sits upon, and the wheels and the tires were full of eyes. And so obviously those are inanimate objects, but that's just the way of describing this awareness, seeing everything, comprehending everything. That's what these creatures have. It's like they share the mind of God or something.
Touche. Yes, it's like they're in sync. They're in the kingdom, in heaven, with God, and they're all in sync. I'm going to read in verse 4, And round about the throne there were 24 seats, and upon the seats I saw 24 elders sitting, clothed in white raiment, and they had on their heads crowns of gold. This leads to a question, the fifth question: what are we to understand by the 24 elders spoken of by John? The answer: we are to understand that these elders whom John saw were elders who had been faithful in the work of the ministry and were dead, who belonged to the seven churches, and were then in the paradise of God. So if you think about the context here, John is exiled to the island of Patmos. He is by himself when he receives this revelation. And he probably worked with these 24 elders who had preached the gospel, and you know, probably most of them had been martyred. And he sees them now in the paradise of God. So I think this is a very hopeful message also for John, that he sees these 24 elders.
I don't think it's limited to those 24. So when you look at the Old Testament, the Levitical priests were organized into 24 orders. Each order would work for 1 week in the temple. So if you think about 24 representing the fullness of the priesthood, then John is seeing 24 elders sitting on the throne. So the fullness of the priesthood, they're all with Jesus, which is the promise to us. And another way you could look at that is, you know, 12 could represent the Old Testament house of Israel, the 12 tribes, and 12 could represent the New Testament universal church with 12 apostles going out into the world. 24, I think, is a very symbolic number. So, yeah, perhaps those were 24 people that John specifically knew, but I also suspect that, again, as with everything else, this is like a universal description that we need to really be liberal with the application of.
Absolutely.
And then that leads us into question number 6, where John talks about a book that he sees, and it's sealed with 7 seals. Joseph asks, what are we to understand? And the answer is, we are to understand that it contains the revealed will, mysteries, and the works of God, the hidden things of his economy concerning this earth during the 7,000 years of its continuance or its temporal existence.
And it's interesting to go to chapter 5 of Revelation where this is talked about. And I'm just going to read here because it's worthy of a read. And I saw on the right hand of him that sat on the throne a book written within and on the backside, sealed with 7 seals. And I saw a strong angel proclaiming with a loud voice, who is worthy to open the book and to loose the seals thereof? And no man in heaven, nor in earth, neither under the earth, was able to open the book, neither to look thereon. And I wept much, because no man was found worthy to open and to read the book, neither to look thereon. And one of the elders said to me, weep not, behold, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, hath prevailed to open the book and to loose the 7 seals thereof. And behold, and lo, in the midst of the throne and of the 4 beasts, and in the midst of the elders, stood a lamb, as it had been slain, having 7 horns and 7 eyes, which are the 7 spirits of God sent forth into all the earth. And he came and took the book out of the right hand of him that sat upon the throne. I read this as saying Jesus, the anointed one, was the only one worthy to take the book out of Jehovah's hand, his father's hand, and open it. And when he had taken the book, this is verse 8, the 4 beasts and the 24 elders fell down before the Lamb, having every one of them harps and gold vials full of odors, which are the prayers of saints. And they sung a new song, saying, thou art worthy to take the book, to open the seals, for thou wast slain and hast redeemed us to God by thy blood out of every kindred and tongue and people and nation, and hast made us unto our God kings and priests, and we shall reign on earth. And then just skipping to verse 12, saying with a loud voice, worthy is the Lamb that was slain to receive power and riches and wisdom and strength and honor and glory and blessing. And every creature which is in heaven and on earth and under the earth, I heard saying, blessing and honor and glory and power be unto him that sitteth upon the throne and unto the Lamb forever and ever. All these creatures, these living things, are worshiping Jesus because he's the only one worthy to have done what he did. to save all of his creations.
The other thing I just want to hit on here is this book itself reminds me of Daniel chapter 12, which also talks kind of about the last days. And it says, at that time, Michael, the great prince who stands watch over your people, will rise up. There will be a time of distress, the likes of which will not have occurred from the beginning of nations until that time. But at that time, your people, everyone whose name is found written in the book, oh, that's like straight out of Revelation, will be delivered. And many who sleep in the dust of the earth will awake, some to everlasting life, but others to shame and everlasting contempt. Then the wise will shine like the brightness of the heavens, and those who lead many to righteousness will shine like the stars forever and ever. Great imagery there. But then Daniel's told, shut up these words and seal the book until the time of the end. Many will roam to and fro, and knowledge will increase. Go on your way, Daniel, for the words are closed up and sealed until the time of the end. Many will be purified, made spotless and refined, but the wicked will continue to act wickedly. None of the wicked will understand, but the wise will understand. You know, the whole book of Revelation is another sealed book that, you know, people try to understand it, but it's going to take revelation from heaven for us to truly understand what John was seeing and what that means for us.
Well, and you relate this to the sealed portion of the Book of Mormon, which we're told contains everything from the beginning of the earth to the end of the earth. And that's the exact description of this book that is being handed from the Father to the Son,
who, yes,
and he has the power to unseal it. So it's the same book.
So since you brought that up, yeah, 2 Nephi 27 verses 6 through 8 talks about this book. It shall come to pass that the Lord shall bring forth unto you the words of a book. And they shall be the words of them which is slumbered. And we have been taught to believe that's the Book of Mormon, but we never read the next verse. And behold, the book shall be sealed, and in the book shall be a revelation from God from the beginning of the world to the ending thereof. Does the Book of Mormon talk about that?
Not the portion that we have, my friend.
So the Book of Mormon cannot be this book, the words of those who have slumbered. And it goes on in verse 8, because of the things which are sealed up, the things which are sealed shall not be delivered in the days of the wickedness and abominations of the people. I think we're still in those days today.
Otherwise, we would have a book.
Right. And then Ether chapter 4, verses 4 through 7, talks more about this. And it says that these words, the vision that Brother Jared saw from the beginning to the end, and the unfolding of all my revelations and the interpretation thereof shall not go forth unto the Gentiles until the day that they shall repent of their iniquity and become clean before the Lord.
So does that mean we're dirty before the Lord?
We're definitely not clean because we don't have it. John is seeing that this book is finally going to be unsealed at the end. And we've got two places in the Book of Mormon that tell us it's not the Book of Mormon, but it will be unsealed before the end. So that takes us into verse 7 here. What are we to understand by the seven seals with which it was sealed? We're to understand that the first seal contains the things of the first 1,000 years, and the second also of the second 1,000 years, and so on until the seventh. Now, one thing that I find helpful is to make sure that we visualize this book properly. Because in John's time, we didn't have rectangular books with bindings. It was a scroll. So when you sealed up a scroll, think about taking a poster and rolling it up into a tube and then putting rubber bands on the outside. You could take one of the rubber bands off and you still got six other rubber bands. You got to get all the rubber bands off before you can unroll the poster. And I think that's the visual image that John is trying to convey here, is there's going to be 7,000 years of history. And once that seventh seal is taken off, then the book can be opened and read and understood. Usually when you were sealing a scroll like that, a lot of times you'd seal it with wax.
Right.
So then you could have seven different wax impressions, and you have to break each one of the wax impressions before you can unroll the scroll.
Because there's nothing here that says that those seals are going to be opened prior to the opening of the seventh seal. It's all that information is stored up there and it's sealed, but when it gets read, it's not until the end.
When the seal is broken, things happen, but it isn't until all of the seals are broken that the book can finally be read.
So you're suggesting that the breaking of, like, the first seal, which means the first 1,000 years, is just symbolic of what's happening during that first 1,000 years, but that scroll is not necessarily read. It's maybe it's recorded during that time, you know, with that first seal. But ultimately, it gets read by Christ at the beginning of the millennium when he comes and unsealed at that time at the final seventh seal.
Yeah, I think a lot of people will have the image of a modern day book, and I break the first seal and I can read the first 10 pages. And then I break the second seal and I can read the next 10 pages. And I go through until I've broken all, but that doesn't seem to be the imagery that John's saying. John is just saying, when we break the first wax seal, all hell's going to break loose in the first 1,000 years. And then when we break the second wax seal, we have all these events in the second. And so we're seeing the progression of human history through the 7,000 years of temporal existence. And then when that final seal is broken, then we can see what it all means and how it all fits together in context. The vision of all things, the end from the beginning.
I have no background in anciently how they wrote on scrolls, but you can think of a scroll as multiple pages being rolled up, and the inner pages could then be sealed. No, doesn't work that way.
Scroll would be just one long sheet, and okay. You just wrote it, and then you roll it up.
Okay.
Sorry.
It doesn't matter, I guess, at the end of the day, because this is figurative. Maybe I'm overthinking it, literally. But regardless, the seals represent 1,000 years and what happened during each of those 1,000 years. Question 8. What are we to understand by the four angels spoken of in the 7th chapter and first verse of Revelation? So let me just go to chapter 7, verse 1. And after these things, I saw four angels standing on the four corners of the earth, holding the four winds of the earth. And the wind should not blow on the earth, nor on the sea, nor on any tree. And so here's the answer. We are to understand that they are four angels sent forth from God, to whom is given power over the four parts of the earth, to save life and to destroy. These are they who have the everlasting gospel to commit to every nation, kindred, tongue, and people, having power to shut up the heavens, to seal up unto life, or to cast down to the regions of darkness. So these seem to be these four angels / messengers with the sealing power, as well as the ability to cast down, to seal somebody up unto everlasting destruction or unto life. To shut up the heavens to me means power over the elements, dearth, lack of rain, any of those sorts of things, but also the everlasting gospel. So these guys have power, assuming they're guys. I don't want to superimpose, you know, a view there per se. What do you think?
A couple of things that jump out at me is these angels have the everlasting gospel to commit to every nation, kindred, tongue, and people. And when we go to Revelation 14:6, he says, I saw another angel fly in the midst of heaven, having the everlasting gospel to preach unto them that dwell on earth, and to every nation, kindred, tongue, and people. And yet we always say that this is Moroni.
Blowing his trumpet on top of the temple.
Right. And yet Revelation chapter 7, verse 1 doesn't really sound like Moroni coming hundreds of years before the second coming. These angels are like right there ushering in the second coming and, you know, causing that no wind blows. Yeah, this is definitely different. Doctrine and Covenants section 88 talks about an angel who commits the everlasting gospel flying through the midst of heaven into all nations, kindreds, tongue, and people. Same words there. And he says, and his message to all the people, both in heaven and on earth, and those that are under the earth, He's talking to the people in the underworld as well. And his message is, fear God and give glory to him who sits on the throne forever and ever, for the hour of his judgment is come. Moroni didn't say that when he came in 1827. And then lastly, Doctrine and Covenants 133, the Lord says, I have sent forth mine angel flying through the midst of heaven, having the everlasting gospel, and he shall appear unto many that dwell on the earth. So in the future, this gospel shall be preached unto every nation, kindred, tongue, and people. This is all something that's going to happen in the future.
Yeah, instead of in the past. It's not Moroni. We can draw that conclusion.
At least it wasn't Moroni in 1827. I'll draw that conclusion.
Well, I'll do you one better here, because we've got in chapter 7, verse 2, a reference to another angel. So we've got these four angels, and then there's this other angel. John says, and I saw another angel ascending from the east, having the seal of the living God. And he cried with a loud voice to the four angels to whom it was given to hurt the earth and the sea, saying, hurt not the earth, neither the sea nor the trees, till we have sealed the servants of our God in their foreheads. And so this is a reference to that 144,000 that will be sealed in their foreheads. And this angel is saying, okay, you four stand down while we go forth and we seal that, those 144. And Joseph then asked the question, what are we to understand by the angel ascending from the east? Revelation 7th chapter, 2nd verse. Answer, we are to understand that the angel ascending from the east is he to whom is given the seal of the living God over the 12 tribes of Israel. Therefore he cried unto the four angels, having the everlasting gospel, saying, hurt not the earth, neither the sea nor the trees, till we have sealed the servants of our God in their foreheads. And if you will receive it, this is Elias, which was to come to gather the tribes of Israel and restore all things. Whoa, this is new information here. This is Elias, Elijah, the restorer. Right? There's Elijah, the preparer, who is John the Baptist. We won't go into that, but we've talked about that in other episodes. But this is Elijah, the restorer.
Another thing I just want to point out here, there are some people who build their whole interpretation of the book of Revelation on the notion that it is a strict chronology. The events in chapter 1 happen before the events in chapter 2, which happen before the events in chapter 3, and then they construct their entire narrative based on that. And they have to overlook a lot of things, because chapter 6 talks about when those four angels unleash all of their hell on earth. And yet chapter 7 says, oh, but before they do that, we're going to go off and do this other stuff. So if your interpretation of the book of Revelation depends on a strict chronology, I would recommend you take a step back and reevaluate, because chapter 6 and 7 break that. The other thing that jumps out at me is sealing the servants of our God in their foreheads. That totally links to other parts of the book of Revelation. You go to chapter 14, 1, the 144,000 have the Father's name written in their foreheads.
Elohim?
No, sorry. No. The only name of God is Yahweh. Revelation 22, 4, these people that are in God's presence, they shall see his face, and his name shall be in their foreheads. And we contrast this to chapters 13 and 14 that identify the mark of the beast as the name of the beast and the mark of his name. And his followers have the name of the beast on their foreheads. So we've got the followers of God that have God's name written on their forehead, and you have the followers of Satan that have his name written on their forehead. And obviously these aren't tattoos. This is, again, a symbolic, figurative expression of which spirit do you list to obey.
Well, I was coming into the Spanish Fork, landing a small Cessna yesterday, and there was another Cessna in the pattern, meaning doing takeoffs and landings. And That Cessna had the mark of the beast. It was Cessna 666.
Oh, wow.
Yes. I had to chuckle when I heard that. I almost wanted to get on the radio and say, I'm flying around with the mark of the beast just over there.
Unfortunately, we don't have to try to explain all of the Book of Revelation because some of that stuff is, wow, tough.
Well, and we're going to get a little more information and another question down about this Elijah the Restorer. So let's just kind of hold off on that one. 10, though, Chris, I have to tell you, has still got me scratching my head. What time are the things spoken of in this chapter to be accomplished? They are to be accomplished in the 6,000 years, or the opening of the sixth seal. Isn't this supposed to happen in the 7,000 years? Because it hasn't happened yet.
And are you saying that because the year 2000 passed and this didn't happen? Or?
Well, I mean, the thing that's more confusing to me, the opening of the sixth. Does that mean the beginning of the 6,000 years?
No, I don't think it means that. I think we have a natural inclination to, as soon as we open it, that's
the
year number one of the 1,000-year period. But I really think that seal represents all 1,000 years. Mm-hmm. And so when you open it, you're opening up the whole 1,000-year period.
Perhaps I'm being way too literal today. I got up on the literal side of the bed instead of the figurative side of the bed. So what this tells us, essentially, is that we are not in the 7,000 years yet.
Correct.
Whatever is going on today is not the beginning of the 7,000 years.
Yeah.
We're still in the sixth.
But all those things that they say have to happen in the sixth year haven't happened yet. So
they're
going to come fast and furious when they do come.
I would agree to that.
Verse 11. What are we to understand by sealing the 144,000 out of all the tribes of Israel, 12,000 out of every tribe? We're to understand that those who are sealed are high priests, ordained under the holy order of God to administer the everlasting gospel. For they are they who are ordained out of every nation, kindred, tongue, and people, again, universal, by the angels to whom is given power over the nations of the earth, to bring as many as will come to the church of the firstborn.
So this is an interesting explanation, because if you were to ask a Jehovah's Witness, they would say, well, we just have to be one of the 144,000 because they're the only ones that are going to be totally saved.
Right.
And the answer here is no, these are 144,000 high priests who have power given them from God to bring as many people as possible into the kingdom prior to the devastations that are going to happen in the last days. So these are high priest missionary prophets, essentially, with great power from God. And so there's not some limited number of 144,000 that some sects like the Jehovah's Witnesses have superimposed on this description in Revelation.
Yep. And I'm going to argue that even the number 144,000 high priests is a symbolic number. And it's not that there is actually someone with a little clicker that's clicking, 134,000. All right, that's it. Everyone else go home. Thank you very much. That number is loaded with symbolic representation. 12, obviously, the 12 tribes of Israel. 1,000 signifying fullness. You square 12,000 times 12,000. So, yeah, I don't think that there is exactly 144,000. There is a large group who are going to go out, and then they're going to go preach to the rest of the world.
Right. Agreed.
Now, here's one interesting thing. If you go read this part of the Book of Revelation, and it talks about the 12 tribes that they're coming from, here's the list of tribes that these 144,000 are pulled from. Judah, Reuben, Gad, Asher, Nephilim, Manasseh, Simeon, Levi, Issachar, Zebulun, Joseph, and Benjamin.
Where's Ephraim?
Ephraim is missing. And Dan is missing.
Do you have an explanation for that?
Well, this is one of those things that has really stumped biblical scholars. And they're like, obviously John knows the 12 tribes. So for him to deliberately drop Dan and Ephraim, he was probably trying to signal something, but we don't know what it is.
Blessing. Now it does say Joseph. So it says Joseph and Manasseh.
Yeah, that's the weird one. Manasseh is the son of Joseph, but Ephraim is also the son of Joseph. So John is doing something very deliberate with this list, but we don't have the context. So Dan was the most northern of the tribes, and there was like this ancient tradition that the Antichrist would come from the tribe of Dan. So some think that that's why Dan was left out, because these are the ones that are sealed.
Well, and it's just glaringly obvious that Ephraim is not in that list, which maybe gets back to your assertion that there's probably more than 144,000. Because it's through Joseph's lineage that the blessings of the gospel were distributed and are yet to be distributed throughout all the 12 tribes. You know, that's one of the amazing things about Revelation. You can't try to be too definitive on anything here. We're waiting for further light knowledge. How does this impact us today? Well, I don't know that it does a lot, except just to understand that some things are going to happen and we'll kind of know where to go reference and understand as they start to unfold.
Yep. Should we move on to verse 12?
Go for it.
What are we to understand by the sounding of the trumpets mentioned in the 8th chapter of Revelation? We are to understand that as God made the world in 6 days, and on the 7th day he finished his work and sanctified it, and also formed man out of the dust of the earth, even so, in the beginning of the 7,000 years, will the Lord sanctify the earth and complete the salvation of man and judge all things, and shall redeem all things except that which he has not put into his power, when he shall have sealed all things unto the end of all things. And the sounding of the trumpets of the seven angels are the preparing and finishing of his work in the beginning of the 7,000 years, the preparing of the way before the time of his coming.
And as you had suggested, in the lead up to and then the opening of the seventh seal, things are going to happen very quickly. And that's what's happening with these trumpets. They're blown, something happens, right? There's a desolation, or the angel took the censer and filled it with fire of the altar and cast it to the earth. And there were voices and thunderings and lightnings and an earthquake. You know, so that's just an example of the fact that the Lord is really calling people to repentance. If they won't do it voluntarily, he's going to give them an opportunity based on their pain. But all this happens with the blowing of these trumpets.
Now, an interesting thing to spend some time looking at is the first five trumpets in Revelation are very similar to the Exodus plagues. So in Exodus, you have hail and fire and thunderings. And in Revelation, we have hail and fire mingled with blood. The second trumpet, the rivers turned to blood and the fish died in the waters in Egypt. And in Revelation, the third part of the sea became blood and a third part of the sea creatures died. In Exodus, men couldn't drink the water. The third trumpet in Revelation, a third part of the waters became bitter and many men died. In Exodus, there was darkness over the land of Egypt. The fourth trumpet, the third part of the sun, moon, and stars are darkened. In Exodus, locusts eat the crops. The fifth trumpet, locusts from the bottomless pit come out to torment men. So John's totally thinking Old Testament stuff. Exodus, Mount Sinai, as he's describing the events of the second coming. And if we don't go back to those and find those links, we're not really being honest to what John was trying to communicate.
So I think about the symbolism of the children of Israel leaving Egypt or Babylon. And that's exactly what is the final call. Get out of Babylon. Get out of Egypt.
And God will fight your battles, and he will stand up to Pharaoh and destroy Pharaoh's armies if you just follow me.
I've never thought about that parallelism. It's so stark, right? children of Israel led out of Babylon by Moses. The Lord fights their battles, and that's exactly what's going to happen this next time around.
Yeah. How deadly shall be.
So verse 13 then. When are the things to be accomplished which are written in the ninth chapter of Revelation? And the ninth chapter of Revelation is where John sees wars and plagues and, you know, all the things that we've just described that are bad that are going to happen. And the answer here, they are to be accomplished after the opening of the seventh seal, before the coming of Christ. So again, we get this sense of all these terrible plagues coming upon the earth before Christ comes. So 14, I think is really a key here. What are we to understand by the little book which was eaten by John, as mentioned in the 10th chapter of Revelation? The answer, we are to understand that it was a mission and an ordinance for him to gather the tribe of Israel. Behold, this is Elias, who, as it is written, must come and restore all things. Again, we have this angel who told the other four angels to stand down, and that was Elias the Restorer, Elijah the Restorer. And then we have John the Revelator identified as Elijah the Restorer here in verse 14.
Who must come and restore all things.
And so when Elijah appeared in the Kirtland Temple, Brigham, when he discovered this, you know, our tradition is now that, well, that was Elijah. He came and initiated the dispensation of the fullness of times. But after that happened, Joseph always talked in the future tense about Elijah coming. And this is just another witness of that, that John has to come again as Elijah the Restorer with a mission to gather the tribes of Israel. And, you know, it's interesting how the Lord says, if you will receive it, if you will actually believe it.
Exactly, yes.
If you will actually believe it, I'm telling it to you. Just read your scriptures and believe it. And yet our tradition totally contradicts this.
The other thing I'll notice is John talks about, you know, he has this commission, this commandment. That's where it says it was a mission and an ordinance. I don't think it was a ritual. I think it was a mission and a commandment, or a rule or a requirement, for him to gather the tribes of Israel. And John says, this was bitter. You know, he tasted it and it was bitter. And I suspect that's because of, you know, those who refused to listen to him, those that he couldn't gather in. And it, again, it's a direct link back to Ezekiel chapter 2, where he's told to eat a scroll and then to preach, so that all the people will know that a prophet has been among them. John continues to riff off of the things that Ezekiel wrote about, and they have similar commissions.
Yeah, chapter 10, verse 10. And I took the little book out of the angel's hands and ate it up, and it was in my mouth, sweet as honey. And as soon as I had eaten it, my belly was bitter. So I think it's the doctrines that are sweet, and the fact, I can see how that interpretation fits.
You're sealing people up to life or to eternal damnation. One's got to be really sweet.
Yes.
And the other one's got to be...
And the fact that there's redemption here is sweet. The doctrine is very sweet. But when that light breaks forth and not everybody receives it, that's a bitter end,
yeah,
for those people, obviously. All right, and then we've got the last question. And, boy, 15 is so important for us to understand. And it actually became the subject of a blog that I wrote entitled Who's Afraid of Section 77? because when I did a search on the word restoration, this was some years back, Section 77 didn't come up. This is on the church's website. I'm like, are they trying to disguise what Section 77 is saying about the restoration? You know, our tradition is, well, the restoration has happened, or according to Elder Nelson, President Nelson, it's continuing. But it's a bummer that our scriptures, this revelation, completely contradicts that.
Yeah, so Revelation chapter 11 talks about these two prophets that preach for 3.5 years, and then they are killed in the streets of the city. Their bodies lay there in the streets for 3 days while everyone's celebrating, and then poof, they're restored to life and they ascend up to heaven. And Joseph tells us that these are two prophets that are to be raised up to the Jewish nation in the last days at the time of the restoration. Oh, you mean 1830? No, I don't mean 1830.
No, and let me just correct you. It's not Joseph that's telling us this. It's the Lord that's telling us this. And they're raised up at the time of the restoration to prophesy to the Jews after they are gathered and built the city of Jerusalem in the land of their fathers. So this obviously hasn't happened.
Right? Yeah, even if you believe that the 1948 establishment of the modern state of Israel is the fulfillment of the Jews building up the city of Jerusalem, well, even that breaks it, because that puts the restoration after 1948, which again can't be anything that happened in Joseph Smith's lifetime.
Well, and a lot of times, I think we have to be careful when we be too literal about the term Jerusalem, because I think there's a tendency to go, oh, that's over in the Middle East, that's over in the state of Israel, and yet Jerusalem is used many times in Scripture to identify the place from which the Lord's people are led. Not being too literal, this could have multiple fulfillments there or here. But the important key part of this is that these two prophets, if they're alive, they haven't started their missions, and certainly they haven't prophesied or been killed in the streets and been resurrected. That's when the time of the restoration happens.
I want to camp on the Jerusalem thing really fast, because if we go to chapter 11, it actually never says the name Jerusalem. So verse 8 says, their dead bodies shall lie in the street of the great city, which spiritually is called Sodom and Egypt, where also our Lord was crucified. And I don't think we need to be literal and think city as one specific city on the map, but I think the state of the world entirely, because later on we're told that in Revelation chapter 17, the woman that John sees, the whore, is that great city which reigns over the kings of the earth. So again, it's not the physical geographic Jerusalem in the Middle East. It's a symbolic organization that is corrupt and evil. We get the great city Babylon in chapter 18. It keeps getting referred to that. So here I would say, you know, again, you've either have Babylon or you have Jerusalem.
And they're preaching to the wicked world.
Yeah.
And it's the wicked world that kills them and rejoices over the fact that these guys can't plague us anymore.
Yep.
They can't use their power of God to bring devastation upon us. And they're happy, but surprise, surprise, they're resurrected, and suddenly their joy turns to sorrow.
Yeah. So I'm not convinced that these two prophets are going to die in the Middle East city that we currently call Jerusalem. It could be any great city where Babylon reigns supreme.
And I could think of many of those.
Yeah.
Well, Chris, this, I think we'll wrap up this episode here. Again, I think I tended to be a little bit too literal in my preparation and thinking here, but I agree with you. We have to take a broad view and just keep our eyes open, because there's much yet to be revealed that we just need to be aware of. And we'll start to see these signs as they unfold if we're aware of them and we're looking for them.
Totally agree. For the listeners that want to do some deeper dives, Dr. Heiser on his Naked Bible podcast has been going through the book of Revelation. I think he usually goes about 3 or 4 episodes per chapter, it seems like. It is very in-depth. He gives a ton of analysis on all the ways that John is linking back to the Old Testament. He's not trying to draw conclusions of what it means for us today, but he is trying to say, when John writes this, he's referring back to this in the Old Testament, and here's the context that we should have in mind when John's doing that. It's been a really mind expanding experience for me to listen to it. So I highly recommend it to all listeners.
And I need to go listen to it. So, well, thanks for joining us this week. We'll post this on Sunday, which is the day after we do the Sunstone presentation. I'm hoping we can get a recording that we can maybe post for everyone. I'm not quite sure about how Sunstone is going to deal with that, but we'll try to get a recording if we can and get it out to everybody. And we're certainly looking forward to that event and that opportunity to introduce the concepts of the book Joseph in the Gap and the hidden history, all the things that we discuss here on the podcast, to a wider audience. So thanks for joining us this week, and we'll catch you next. Take care.